I'm Artie Moscowen. Welcome back to Radio Times. At the auto show in Detroit last month, Transportation Secretary Anthony Fox said the Obama administration is bullish on autonomous vehicles and will get rid of some of the regulatory hurdles. What was seen as science fiction not so long ago, self-driving cars are becoming a reality. The market for electric cars is getting more competitive. The Chevy Bolt has been getting a lot of buzz as the first mass-marketed electric vehicle that could get as much as 200 miles per charge. Meanwhile, Volkswagen is still dealing with the cheating scandal involving their diesel technology. Today, in this hour of Radio Times, cars. And we have two guests who have joined us. Dan Neal is an automotive critic. He writes the Rumble Seat column that runs Saturdays in the Wall Street Journal. And Dan Neal, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Also with us is Ezra Dyer. He's automotive editor for Popular Mechanics, a columnist for Car and Driver, and a video producer for Yahoo Autos. Ezra Dyer, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Hello.
Nice to have you both here. Dan, let me begin with you. How much do you think these low gas prices that we are enjoying these days, how much is that affecting the auto industry?
Well, in one way, it's a kind of ironic because the disconnect between low gas prices and the rationale for having fuel-efficient vehicles is on everyone's minds, and people are wondering, you know, why do we have these exotic measures to save fuel when fuel is so cheap? But it's a cyclical thing. Obviously, the car companies know that. And beyond that, the template has already been made. When the Obama administration extracted 54.5 MPG CAFE standards from the car makers in 2025, you know, that and there are like standards around the world. That really, then the die was cast. And so regardless of what fuel prices are, the technology that drives automobiles is weirdly agnostic to it.
Hmm. So it's kind of, and it's sort of baked into, I guess, the cars that are going to be built for the future. How do you see, Ezra, the health of the auto industry? I think selling something like 17.5 million vehicles in 2015, those are pretty good numbers.
Well, the interesting thing about how electric cars are doing versus everything else and as it relates to gas prices is that people – you know, don't really have the ability to think beyond next week, never mind a few years from now, and where gas prices might go. So, yes, GM just had record profits based largely on the sale of huge trucks and SUVs. Gas is cheap, so, hey, why not? Now, a few years from now, if I were a betting man, you know, what are the resale values going to be on all the Tahoes if gas goes back up to $4 a gallon? It's a volatile thing, and that's the tricky thing for the car makers is that they've got to keep getting better regardless of where the prices are now, because for one thing, as Dan said, the regulations are going to drive them in that direction anyway. But also, you know, you want to be positioned for that moment, like I believe it was in 2008 when briefly the Honda Civic outsold the F-150 because gas became so expensive. I mean, it will happen again. It's just a question of when.
Absolutely. Dan, going back to you, you drove this Chevy Volt. I think you drove it from either Los Angeles to San Francisco or the other way, San Francisco to Los Angeles. What was your take on the Chevy Volt, V-O-L-T?
Oh, thank you for clarifying. Yes, it's been a bit of a marketing hiccup that Volt and Bolt are a bit hard to distinguish. They need sign language is what I think. But
nonetheless.
But anyway, no, regarding the Volt is a technical evolution of the car we saw in 2010 in all respects. It's smooth. It's comfortable. It's practical. It's reasonably commodious. So it's better. The machine is certainly better. I want to go back to something you were talking about. You know, the American consumer is not the only learning animal in play here. Will General Motors, which is making record profits on selling, you know, Cadillac Escalades and Tahoes, just like the old days, at a time of rock-bottom gas prices, just like the old times, at a time when subprime lending in the automobile sector is, starting to worry a lot of people, will they see the cliff again once they go when they're about to go over it?
And you're talking about people who are, what, buying cars? They maybe can't afford or paying, you know, skyrocketing prices once some of those rates kick in.
Well, there are many things to consider, but right now, automobiles are expensive, and there's a lot of subprime lending in that market. What it really points to is General Motors has positioned itself now, for example, to accept something like a 10 million vehicle seasonally adjusted average rate of sales, about, you know, two-thirds of what there is now. But nobody really knows which way the market could go. You know, it could stay at 18 million for the foreseeable future, or it might collapse to 5 million in the next 10 years.
Well, let me go back to you, Ezra. I mean, nonetheless, there are these electric cars that are in showrooms and people are driving them. And it looks like the technology is developing and getting even better, thinking about the Chevy Bolt, B-O-L-T, as much as 200 miles per charge. That seems like an extraordinary breakthrough. What do you think?
It very well may be a breakthrough, but I still feel like I'm a big proponent of electric cars. I think they're great to drive, and they answer the actual needs that a lot of people have. But they're not going to get all the way there to mass market acceptance until they really, until everybody's Tesla style with quick charging and a ton of range. The Bolt, 200 miles, yeah, I mean, that would be probably four times what most people need on a daily basis. But I'm curious to see how it will be embraced, or whether it will, whether it can compete yet with the, yeah, I can pull up to a gas pump anywhere and fill this thing up in 5 minutes and I'm on my way again and again and again. I think we're getting there. We're getting there faster than anybody expected, given that 5 or 6 years ago there were no electric cars, and now we already have self-driving 300 mile range, 0 to 60 in 2.8 second Teslas running around, and soon a $35,000 Chevy that'll go 200 miles. But there's going to be a point where they cross over, and I'm not sure we're quite there yet.
To you, Dan, just going back to the Chevy Volt, it sounds like it was a good experience. I mean, broadly speaking, a good experience for you, especially for a car at that price.
Oh, you're always speaking of the Volt again?
Yeah, we're back to the Volt, yes.
Okay, well, the Volt, you know, I tested the Volt under worst-case scenario. The L.A. to San Francisco drive is not what it's designed for. It's a city car, and once it gets beyond its all-electric range, it becomes a little less pleasant to drive, especially over the Grapevine in California. But as a city car, before the battery runs low and the gas engine kicks in, it's a beautiful car, and it sort of perversely illustrates that why battery powered cars are superior feeling and driving, and they're more serene, and they have many qualities that when the IC engine kicks on, those qualities sort of dissipate, and that's one thing that's really also interesting about the Chevy Bolt, which I had a chance.
You did the Chevy Bolt as well?
Yes, I drove it a couple of weeks ago with the 60 kilowatt hour battery, 200 mile range, 150 horsepower, 0 to 60 in under 7 seconds, and a cost of, they're marking $30,000, which those are the two numbers, the 200 mile and $30,000. Those are magic metrics sort of laid out by Elon Musk of Tesla, among others. But it's been considered kind of the threshold for consumer acceptability. And, you know, it's there. It's absolutely there. The Bolt is a triumph of – I did it a second.
I know. That's okay. That's okay. We're with you.
Bolt, that's the all-electric one that's really cute that you really, really want. That's what I'm trying to say.
I got you.
That is a triumph of procurement, because it used to be that it would cost $1,000 per kilowatt hour of lithium energy storage. That was just when the first Bolt came out. This car, a kilowatt hour of energy storage is $145, and that, and it's just going down. So gas is cheap, but so are electrons.
Let me go back to you, Ezra. We've been talking about this, you know, whether it's a pent-up demand or certainly demand for cars, but there is at least a portion of millennials, I happen to have one in my family, who don't have cars. Factor that, I guess, into where you see cars going or how in the future, or perhaps even now, there's a lot of the, you know, the zip cars and things like that, that young people or young adults seem to be more interested in than actually owning a car. How should we think about that, especially its impact on either car development or the industry itself?
Well, Dan and I can argue about this, I suppose, but
go ahead.
My personal look at it is that there are always going to be people who need cars and are interested in cars, and I know there have been a couple of, you know, notable statistics lately. You know, the driver's licenses are down amongst people under the age of 25 and things like that. And is that because cars are no longer cool or they're no longer interested, or is it because cars are expensive and that demographic doesn't have as much money as they used to? And urbanization, people are moving to the cities, and, you know, maybe even if you're the biggest car nut in the world, if you live in Manhattan, you can't afford and don't want a car because it's a big pain to have it. So I think there are other factors involved in the decline of driver's licenses. But, you know, I'm in a relatively rural part of North Carolina, and if you talk to any kid around here who's 16 years old, they all want their driver's license because, yes, they can go on their phones and they can interact with all of their friends, but if you want to go to a party, you're still, you know, you're getting in a car or you're going, you know, you can't do everything through your phone. I think that's kind of a, that's like the cool myth that's getting put out there is that, yeah, kids don't actually do anything in person anymore. Therefore, they don't want cars.
Well, and you certainly don't want your mom driving you to a party. That's for sure.
Well, hey, maybe in the not so far future, your car itself will drive you to the party. But,
yes.
You know, the car is still a necessary feature for, you know, a lot of people in America. Not everybody lives in cities, and if you don't live in a city or even a particularly walkable suburb, hey, there's a lot of people in L.A. who live in a city. They still need cars.
Well, about a minute, I do want to talk about autonomous or self-driving cars after the break. But, Dan, anything you want to say in response to what Ezra just said?
Well, yeah, it reminds me of Pauline Kael's quote, you know, when Nixon was elected, she said, "I can't believe it. Nobody I know voted for him." but the fact is that the U.S. population is largely urban and growing more so, up to 90% in the next 20 years. Here's a staggering statistic. Mentions of the automobile in social media among 14 to 17 year olds is down 27% in 6 years. The quick handle for this is, why doesn't Johnny drive? And I think for many of the reasons Ezra already named.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about cars in this hour of Radio Times. The auto show just leaving Philadelphia. Dan Neal, automotive critic. He writes the Rumble Seat column, which runs Saturdays in the Wall Street Journal. He's one of our guests, as is Ezra Dyer. He's an automotive editor for Popular Mechanics, also a columnist for Car and Driver and a video producer for Yahoo Autos. And you can join the conversation, especially if you're in the position of looking for a car. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moskowang talking with Dan Neal and Ezra Dyer about cars, the latest in automotive design and technology. Dan Neal, automotive critic for the Wall Street Journal, and Ezra Dyer, automotive editor for Popular Mechanics. And you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. I see comments coming in, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Ezra, let me go back to you, but Dan, I want to get you in on this as well. And I remember doing shows a couple of years ago about autonomous cars or self-driving cars, thinking, you know, maybe when I'm dead, they will be here. But it looks like, Ezra, they are close to being on the horizon. How should we think about autonomous cars?
I think we should be psyched. I mean, what's worse than sitting in traffic and, you know, staring at the bumper of the car in front of you? And, you know, maybe occasionally you stop paying attention for a moment and then you crash into the car in front of you. And things like that are happening, and worse. So, I mean, I love driving, but also a lot of the time I hate driving, like anyone. So in those circumstances, if my car can take over some of that stress and or danger, I think it's a fantastic thing. And it's come, like the electrification, it's come a long way in the last 5 or 6 years. I think 5 years, the 2010 Lincoln MKT was the first car I drove that could parallel park itself, and that was like a little piece of magic, that parlor trick. And now we're at the point where cars can pretty competently take over on the highway, at least at low speeds, and now increasingly at higher speeds. The Volvo XC90 has pilot assist, they call it, where under 30 miles an hour, it will lock on the car in front of you with its radar.
Wow.
And it's got cameras, and it can follow the lines on the road, so it can competently take over in traffic, and I think that's great. It's a good it's a good stress relief, and it's good for safety. Maybe insurance rates will go down. There's a lot of good things that are going to happen with autonomous cars. They're not by any means perfect yet, but they keep adding these layers. It's you know one layer goes on top of the next, and we get a little bit better. And I'm not sure how soon we're all going to be riding around in completely autonomous cars, but they're becoming capable of handling themselves in a lot of situations a lot more rapidly than people had expected.
Maybe better drivers, if I can put it that way, Dan, than people, because of we all know how distracted people are with their cell phones and everything else as they're driving through traffic lights and things like that.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to overstate the facts, but yeah, human beings are terrible drivers.
They are. And getting worse, I should say.
They're just miserable. And and yes, of course, the machine itself will drive much better. And I have a pretty strong feeling that it'll be no more than 10 years before we have what is called level 4 autonomy available on the mass market. And those cars will be able to drive and deliver and park and do all of those things for themselves, for their customers.
And you can see, I mean, with bits and pieces, whether it's the camera, you know, the camera in the back of the car or some of the beeps and things for some of the newer cars, you can see the car technology, Dan, going in that direction.
Yeah. Can I just point out a policy issue that I think is important to deal with right at this moment?
Sure.
That a lot of car makers, Tesla included, are just forging on alone and largely self-supporting in terms of the mapping of the world. You know, they're compiling a highly detailed digital map of the world among Teslas on the road. So this environment, this digital environment, other cars can negotiate. Other car makers are holding back. General Motors, for example, thinks that there needs to be more robust bureaucratic effort, if you will, on the federal levels. So we have connected cars to infrastructure and so forth, which would no doubt would be a win over cars that are purely autonomous. But I'm just there's a point here in policy where we can spend a lot of money achieving this sort of integrated, thoroughly aware infrastructure, or we can spend a lot less money to get 90% there. And I think this is a clear difference in the next 3 years in terms of approach to this tech.
Well, and what's so interesting about when thinking about autonomous vehicles, Ezra, is that, as it turns out, cars are mostly not used. Mostly they're either sitting at home or they're sitting in a garage somewhere. Does that open up some possibilities, the fact that mostly cars are just sitting around?
Well, if you subscribe to the notion that the car is going to be able to back out of the garage and go pick someone up when you're not using it, then I guess we could get a lot more use out of our cars. I think that might be, as Dan alluded, if that's 100%, we're not going to get to 100% very quickly, but we could get to 90%. And so maybe that'll be the final piece of the puzzle that comes into play. And really, I wouldn't be surprised by anything at this point. But I do think that if you can get there with the car itself, like you said, 90% of the time, Audi did a presentation or stunt, whatever it was. It was a challenge at Sonoma Raceway last summer where they had an RS7 that drove around the track by itself, mapped the track, and then used differential GPS to steer itself around, GPS and its cameras to see the road, and that thing could book it around the track. I'll tell you, when you're riding in the car and watching the steering wheel sawing back and forth and listening to the tires squealing, it would make a believer in you that, yeah, this is the kind of thing that could be not that far off. And in that case, you know, there wasn't, to my knowledge, you know, there's no telling what the Volkswagen people can get up to. But to my knowledge, there was no cheating going on with the track itself having any kind of beacons to tell the car where it was. It was all on the car.
Yeah, did you want to add to that, Dan?
No, that's a rich story. I think the yes, this technology is coming at us like a freight train. It's very, how you say, very little has been reflected upon on a policy level. The government, as you said, Secretary Fox said they're going to try and step out of the way. What does that mean? Really, the entire rule book needs to be thrown out, from crash standards to efficiency. Autonomy changes everything, as better minds than I have said. It's the biggest thing that happened to automobiles since the automobile, and we really need it really calls for a clean screen redesign of the machine.
Let me get a caller in. Speaking to something we were just referencing, this is Joshua from Fishtown. Joshua, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi.
Hi there.
I'm just wondering, you know, if we have 50, 100 million cars in the country and they're being utilized at 2% or 3%, why do I even need to own a car in 20 years if we have autonomous cars? Why don't we have, like, a fleet of cars that's just available on demand? You know, it just seems like a incredible waste of resources and an opportunity if we can fix that.
Yeah, Dan, I think it was you, Dan, that there wrote something about that.
Yes, your caller's very very prescient in that respect. Yes, I just wrote an article all about this, about called The End of Ownership. And exactly right. What's going to happen with autonomously enabled car sharing? People will be able to dip into this vast ecosystem of automobiles that they'll own just for a fraction of a time. If they need a pickup, they'll call, it'll arrive, they use it, it goes away. Now, other people have said car sharing is like bed sharing. That it's, you know, kind of icky and gross, the idea that people would go in and out of cars. So I think the next growth industry, at least for me, is car detailing.
Oh, interesting. So you can, what, customize it depending on who's driving it?
Absolutely. In fact, the Chevy Bolt has very robust electronics, or I should say, Wi-Fi and recognition powers. It knows exactly who's approaching the car, what kind of music they like, how they like their seat, all that stuff. Well, that's pretty low-hanging fruit. But the point of all that is to enable the car to be more easily shared and sort of instantly tailorable to the person who summoned it.
Well, we are talking about cars in this hour of Radio Times. That's Dan Neal. Automotive critic, he writes the Rumble Seat column for the Wall Street Journal. It runs on Saturdays. Also with us, Ezra Dyer, automotive editor for Popular Mechanics, a columnist for Car and Driver, and a video producer for Yahoo Autos. And we can take some more phone calls at 1-888-477-9499. A lot of comments here, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Ezra, I do want to talk about Volkswagen and also this diesel or clean diesel technology, as it has been called. And you said for a while, or perhaps even now, you're actually a big fan of diesel technology. Why?
Well, I guess I'd have the caveat that I'm a fan of diesel depending on the application. I think that for trucks and SUVs, diesel makes a lot of sense. You know, Range Rover rolling out a diesel that takes a Range Rover Sport from 19 miles per gallon or 20 miles per gallon up to 29, that's a no-brainer. You go for that. Where it's something like a Volkswagen, where those cars were getting around, you know, they should get around maybe mid-40s if they're not cheating, I'm not sure that that's really a great way to go diesel, because you can get plenty of gas-powered cars these days that not even, you know, not to speak of things like the Prius that easily get above 50 miles per gallon, but your run-of-the-mill Mazda 3, Chevy Cruze, you know, 40 miles per gallon isn't that hard to get anymore. We're talking about highway. So the advantages for diesel kind of diminish, I think, as the cars get smaller. And that's really, I'm not sure that Volkswagen, at least, is coming back from this, for their small cars, because
they cheated.
You know, if they're really playing by the rules, then I'm not sure that it's going to, the technology is going to make a case for itself when everything else is advancing so rapidly, hybrids and just even conventional gasoline engines.
Well, Dan, I mean, I guess there is a question about the future of Volkswagen. You say related to all this cheating involved, I guess it was emissions cheating with these Volkswagens. You basically say trust no one. And yet there were many people who bought these cars thinking, you know, I'm going to get good mileage and I'm not going to hurt the environment. What do they, you know, where do they stand on this scandal?
Well, I have to tell you, before we get to them, I'm talking about me. My feelings were hurt. When I wrote Trust No One, I was feeling betrayed. And I think the sense of betrayal, far beyond sort of the dollars and cents of whatever reparations happen. I mean, man, that's going to take a long time to burn off. Will Volkswagen come back? Of course. I mean, they have taken on a decade's worth of liabilities they weren't counting on. And as Ezra said, you know, this creates a technical turning point. And it's a part of a larger picture. This scandal was a result of trying to achieve the impossible with existing technology, and they could not reach it with existing technology, so they hacked the test. It's the Kobayashi Maru solution, if you will, from Star Trek. But so I think that if Volkswagen comes back, they have to embrace another regime. Certainly, I think diesel in the United States is doomed as a brand. And because of Euro 6 requirements overseas, very, very strict on particulate and NOx and all that good stuff, you know, diesel may be very much on the way out.
Well, and I mean, there are other car companies, Ezra, that use, you know, that tout this clean diesel. Are they also suspect, do you think?
Would
we know by now?
Since the Volkswagen scandal, I have noticed that a lot of car companies that build diesels are going out of their way to explain every aspect of the emissions control system that they never would have talked about before, because they rightly feel that they're going to be under the spotlight from everybody to make sure that they're playing by the rules. The interesting thing for me, when I did a story on this and I talked to some actual Volkswagen TDI owners, and my expectation was that most of them were going to be personally affronted, and they were going to be feel like someone had really, really wronged them and morally outraged about it, like Dan is. And as it turned out, a lot of them are actually just a lot more pragmatic. And, you know, they liked the 50 miles per gallon on the highway that the car was getting with its emission control systems disabled. And you know what? A lot of them weren't planning on fixing it real soon, because if the fix was going to require that they go into the dealership and, say, reflash the computer so that now the engine's burning more fuel to keep everything hotter, to burn off the oxides of nitrogen, then they weren't going to really – they didn't really care so much about that 40 times over the limit thing so much as they cared about keeping their 50 miles per gallon. So that was interesting to me, that the Volkswagen TDI crowd, at least a lot of the ones that I talked to, they weren't as diehard on the clean diesel thing as they were on the saving money thing.
The mileage thing, and this is Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me read some of the comments here. Tweet from Eileen. She says, what about electric minivans? Moms drive a lot. Dan, are there, my ignorance is totally on display here. Are there electric minivans?
What was that person saying?
That was Eileen, a tweet from Eileen.
Eileen, absolutely. She and I are in exactly the same boat. There's not a good full-size electric minivan, and I need one. But I tell you what, you can get a Ford EV. What is it called, Ezra? A C-Max.
The C-Max, but C-Max Energy. Chrysler's right. Coming out with a plug-in Pacifica.
There you go. So
right.
It's coming.
And also, I have to say, the Bolt, except for the swing doors, it has what's called D-segment interior space, so it's really, really big inside, plenty of room for car seats and storage in the back. But it's in a B. Package, that is, it's a relatively small car because that's great thing about electric cars. Anyway, that is a possibility as an alternative.
And then if you've got 130 grand to spend, there's always the Tesla Model X.
Oh, yeah, I forgot that one.
Linda from Havertown says, for the hybrid vehicles, what's the environmental impact of recycling the batteries versus a gas-powered engine? Ezra, have you looked at that?
That I will frankly say that I have no clue what it where does the battery in your Prius go? I think that chances are it probably goes into another Prius that needs one for the time being.
I know.
And as the batteries get better and better, I think what's going to happen is people are going to incorporate them into their home power systems. Tesla right now sells the Powerwall, which are relatively tiny batteries that you're supposed to mount in your garage and use them either as a backup generator or to supplement solar panels. And I just had solar panels installed in my house, so I was looking at the Powerwall to see how that might fit into the system. And really, the problem with the Powerwall is that it's a fraction of the capacity of even a Chevy Volt, which doesn't have a huge battery. So I think what's going to happen is, Once your Chevy Volts and Bolts and all those things outlive their usefulness as cars, you've still got a pretty robust battery there that is outside its warranty maybe, and maybe not giving you your 200 miles of charge, but you can stick it in your house and use it as a backup generator. You know, if you've got a lithium ion battery that'll hold say 10 kilowatt hours of juice, there's always going to be a use for that.
Dan, we're almost having a break, but I heard you say, "I know."
I forget what I was so entranced with what Ezra was saying. I forgot what I knew. I know about the recycling. Lithium batteries
quickly.
Are 100% recyclable, and they are absolutely it's a closed system. The materials are valuable, and they get recycled indefinitely so far. And also the issue about the battery failure, very few battery failures overall to worry about. Probably far more engine fires.
Oh, interesting. Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking about cars with Dan Neal and also with Ezra Dyer. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Ezra Dyer. He's automotive editor for Popular Mechanics, a columnist for Car and Driver, a video producer for Yahoo Autos. Also with us, Dan Neal, automotive critic, and he writes the Rumble Seat column, which appears in the Wall Street Journal on Saturdays. Yes, we are talking about cars, I guess, and drivers. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. A couple of tweets here. One from Janine says, VW Diesel, RE, the VW Diesel, we're hurt. We feel guilty, though we tried and we researched. A tweet from Jay says, my Audi was ensnared in the recall. Does that make me a victim or a chump? Dan, can you answer Jay's question?
Me?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I think it's a false alternative, really. I think he's both.
Just we'll leave it at that.
Well, I mean, I feel terrible for people who've done that. And I think Ezra's right. You know, there's going to be a large amount of non-compliance when it comes to the fix. People are going to not want to compromise their vehicle performance to make this happen. And I think that here's the problem. For the next 20 years, anything that Volkswagen says is going to be, kind of held askance because, they've really eroded their trust. And in terms of engineering, you know, we as critics and people and consumers can only rely on what the engineers tell us. We're not inside. We don't have their data. So credibility is hugely important in that communication. And they have pretty well shot a hole in that boat.
Let me get John from, looks like, Erdenheim to join our conversation. John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi.
Hi there.
Thank you.
Sure.
It's a good show.
Thank you.
I go back to the days of hot rodding, in the late 50s, 60s, where the older kids were modifying, building, hacking. And I've worked as a mechanic off and on throughout my life. My question is, and it's never really exposed to the public, when new technology, especially with cars, comes on, there's a lot of sale and hype, and it does this and that, but it's never told what it's going to cost when you take it into a dealership and you are tethered to a dealer when you buy a new car for a number of years, what it's going to cost, because the maintenance fees they're getting per hour today, it's really sticker shop. And I just don't know if there's a solution for the public in the future where they could be made aware of what this thing's going to cost them, and or what you see in the horizon as far as what's it going to cost you to maintain these vehicles.
To maintain it, yeah. I mean, hopefully people are learning some of that when they're buying these cars. But Ezra, what do you say back to John?
Well, it's not going to cost anything because those cars are going to get scrapped. I mean, not that long ago, when cars were largely analog, they could be fixed by people with relatively, you know, a basic set of tools or a well-equipped garage. You could build your own Duesenberg from scratch, the nicest car of the day. Now, you couldn't build a Mercedes C-Class. There's going to be things that, you know, proprietary computer systems that are built into these cars that once they go haywire, unless the car company continues to support them indefinitely, which I think seems unlikely, I think the cars are just going to be, you know, they're going to be totaled effectively. You know, what do you do? Well, look in a new S-Class and tell me how you fix that 80 years from now. Maybe you're talking, you know, shorter term in the future.
Yeah.
And in that case, I think what happens is people just drive them with things broken.
Well,
you know?
But I wonder, Dan, the first car I ever bought, which was back in the 60s, I think I went through five transmissions because it was such a lemon. But can we say the cars, yes, they're probably more expensive, but the cars are better made today and they last a lot longer?
Oh, yeah, you can say that because we just look at the average life in the fleet. You know, the average car is something like 12 or 13 years old. And so that speaks to a durability and sort of a conquest of automotive engineering. Yeah, these things are really OEMs build great products. They're really tough, really well tested. That things go wrong, like the ignition switch scandal or the VW incident, just goes to show what a monumentally complex task it is to build a modern car.
Yeah.
But I have a thought for the caller. Electric vehicles are vastly simpler than internal combustion cars, and the failure rates would be minimal. In fact, that's one reason people thought originally the GM killed the electric car is because they'd lose so much at the dealership. As you point out, you know, it's highway robbery at the dealerships. So, I think in the age of electric cars, there'd be very few sort of service bays.
Let me see what Walter from West Philadelphia has to say. Walter, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, gentlemen. I think the previous caller kind of took a little bit of what I was going to ask on the same vein, that some of the decrease in younger people having an interest in cars is, you know, the over-gadgetization and technology has been built into them that has made cars no longer affordable and no longer to be worked on. And while they're better built, they're kind of boring.
They're boring. Well, that's interesting. Walter, let me take your question, and actually I'll throw it back to you, Dan. As you mentioned, the fact that you know, cars can last 10 or 12 or even more years. How about the used car market? And it is true. I mean, a new car these days is, even at the low end, is still, what, $25,000,
$30,000? Yeah, it's true. And the used car market, I mean, if we're talking practical advice, used car market is absolutely a very cool place to go, especially, if I may say, for fast cars. Because fast cars depreciate more quickly, which is great for us who like fast cars. And so, you know, the used car market is excellent. Also, you notice in this economic recovery, there's been much more inventory discipline in the used car market than there was the last time around. So among new cars, it's a little more, even a little more leveraged than it is in the used car market. So it's a more stable market.
And Ezra, you have driven some really fast cars, a McLaren that goes as much as 200 and what, 6 miles per hour. You recently drove a Lamborghini Aventador. Dorado, do I have that right?
Of the Aventador Superveloce.
Superveloce.
And it got, what, 13 miles per gallon, right?
And you have to say it like that.
Okay.
Yes, it got 13 miles per gallon, and the seats were not adjustable, and it had no cruise control and no stereo, and it was horribly uncomfortable and loud, and it was awesome, and I loved it.
And it costs what, $500,000, something like that?
Yeah, it costs $500,000, but don't worry about it because they sold them all, and I think they only made 150, and they were all sold out. So,
so what was it like to, even if the seats were uncomfortable, what was it like to drive?
Driving a car like that is, it's always an event. Everybody is looking and taking photos. Then, you know, when you get into a normal car after that, you go, why isn't anybody looking at me? And then you remember that you're no longer driving this, you know, this thing that looks like a 3 foot tall spaceship. It's fun. You know, you get a kick out of it. But in terms of cars that would, you know, there are other cars that have the same effect for a lot less money. Not to loop it back around to the used car thing, but what Dan was saying about fast cars depreciating, I was driving a Ford Focus ST Mountain MP275 a few weeks ago, which is like this.
I don't even know what that means. Yeah, no, go ahead.
It's a hot tuned up version of a Ford Focus, and I think it ended up being in the mid to high $30,000 range, which completely misses the audience that it would appeal to, which is 16-year-olds. But I was thinking, you know what? This is going to be a great car for somebody to get their first speeding ticket in, you know, 10 or 15 years from now.
My pet peeve, and I'll just throw it out there, is, and I don't know if this is a new thing, Dan, but people run red lights. I just astounds me when I see people the light turns red and people think they can go through that. Have you?
Can I have some more information about this? Where is this happening? In Philadelphia?
Well, Philadelphia, I mean, I'm looking at my engineer. He's nodding his head. Yes, I see it everywhere. People,
do you think it's everywhere? Isn't Philadelphia, I'm sorry to tell you.
Right. I mean, I get around, but anyway.
Perhaps it's cultural, specific to the town. Some towns have incredible red light discipline, I've noticed, and others don't. I wonder why.
And conversely, there's the problem of people not going when the light turns green because everybody is looking at their phones, which the Subaru EyeSight system actually has a camera up on the top of the windshield, and one of the functions that it has is it keeps an eye on the car in front of you, and when the car in front of you pulls away, and if you don't pull away, then it chirps at you like, hey.
Oh,
hey, that's
interesting.
Traffic's moving.
Well, we are talking about humans and cars, and that's Ezra Dyer, automotive editor for Popular Mechanics. He's a columnist for Car and Driver, and he's also a video producer for Yahoo Autos. Dan Neal with us as well, automotive critic, and he writes the Rumble Seat column for the Saturday edition of the Wall Street Journal. And yes, we're talking about cars and humans and how they drive them. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me read a couple more email comments from Joe. Can you ask your guests about the new Ford Mustang? Dan, can you take that one?
Oh, no, that's an Ezra.
That's an Ezra question. Go ahead, Ezra.
Okay, I'll field that. Well, I don't know specifically what he wants to know about the Mustang, but the news with the Mustang is the GT350, a new model that they just came out with. That, without getting too deep into the technical aspect of how internal combustion engines generally work, this one is the firing order of the engine is a lot more like a Ferrari than a typical Mustang or Chevy or any other V8. So it's got this high-pitched wail to it. It revs to, I think the red line's 8250, and that's the new hot commodity for Mustangs. And they've made an even hotter version of that, the GT350R. It's got carbon fiber wheels.
Wow. Yeah.
They're on their game, but so is GM with the new Camaro. The new Camaro is a nice piece of work as well. So, and then you've got the Hellcat with 707 horsepower. So we're in a golden age of American coupes, I would say.
You agree with that, Dan?
Oh, absolutely. I think one thing is all of these cars are alarmingly fast. I mean, ridiculously stout. And you need a credit card to buy one. And it's really, it's just, I mean, as we're talking about a 700 horsepower Dodge Hellcat, which, by the way, the Corvette is a little bit quicker.
Oh, is that?
But, I mean, it's really, these are amazing automobiles, and we're lucky to be able to drive them.
Let me see what Terry from Wayne has to say. Terry, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, I have a question with respect to electric cars. The battery warranty is, generally speaking, 8 years. And at the end of 8 years, you're going to be faced with a cost maybe $4,500, $5,000 on an eight-year-old car.
Why?
Is that a legitimate concern?
Well, Dan, you say why?
Yeah, just because the warranty's out doesn't mean the battery fails. I mean, it's warrantied for 8 years. Now, cars themselves are not immortal. You know, automobile engines fail. Automobile bodies corrode. Electronics become obsolete. I mean, the car doesn't go on immortally, so the battery only has to outlast, you know, the next comparable part in an IC car. So, and besides, you know, very few batteries have come back as a failure over time. It's really a very, very low rate. Surprisingly, Toyota and Honda both have been stunned by how few batteries they've had to replace.
But isn't there a decline in the performance of a battery over time?
Absolutely. And that, as all batteries, they do decline. And at some point, that performance loss will, you know, pass a minimum threshold of usability. Then those batteries can have a second life. GM, Toyota, Honda all have second life battery, what would you call them, pathways. And so that does, that was talking about what Ezra was mentioning earlier. But, you know, these cars, I think you can count on 10 years and then the companies will buy them back and recycle the batteries.
Looking at the several screens staring at me, Ezra, I see there's a lot of, looks like a lot of suspicion about either electric cars or autonomous cars. And I mean, I guess the auto industry has to be a couple steps, hopefully, in front of consumers and then drag them or lead them along. Are you surprised that people are so suspicious?
Well, there's the problem with building a car is that, you know, what we're seeing now is something that was hatched at least 4 years ago, probably more like five. So, you know, you've got to be a car designer, you've got to look into the future. As for the suspicion on the electric car front, I'll tackle that first. I just think there's a lot of misinformation about how electric cars work, where your electricity is coming from. You know, the thing that I keep hearing is, your electric car is actually not as clean as a internal combustion engine car because your electricity is coming from coal. Well, if you live in West Virginia, then, you know, maybe there's an argument that if you're 100% coal in your electricity, then it's comparable. But, you know, the thing about electric cars, your electricity can come from anything. It can come from solar panels, or it could come from a dam, or nuclear power. So I'm pretty pro electric car on that front. And I don't really understand that line of reasoning. When people are critical of the range and everything, yeah, I understand that doesn't work for everyone, and they are still relatively expensive. But I think that in another, you know, it's happening very quickly. Like I said, 5 or 6 years ago, I was at the Michelin Challenge by Bendum in China, which was an alternative fuel vehicle conference, and I was riding with two German engineers, both of whom were named Hans, and I asked them, from BMW, I said, if we had no fossil fuels tomorrow, how are we going to get around? Would it be nuclear power plants and hydrogen fuel cells? And they said, yeah, that's the only way we could do it.
Wow. Well,
and now here we are not that long, you know, not that far later, and we've got BMW's got their i3, and we've got Teslas and a whole lot more coming down the road. So give it another 10 years, and everybody's always suspicious of new things when it's fresh and you're not familiar with it and it's not what you grew up with, there's going to be some resistance.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Ezra Dyer, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Daniel, thank you for joining us as well.
My pleasure.
Fun to talk to the two of them together about cars. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about the program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Abby Sarfo is our new intern. Welcome, Abby. The show produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us.